Good afternoon, good wet afternoon. We are ready with one case on our docket for argument today. Fleming versus the State of Texas. Are the lawyers ready?
Yes.
Good, I'll ask Megan to call the case.
The court will now call Fleming versus Gay, which is the Gladden Garden for the felon, and which happened on Friday, Gay.
Mr. Gladden?
Thank you. Good afternoon. May it please the court. First of all, I appreciate, I noticed that y'all allowed us a little additional time to argue today. I think the state will join me in saying that we probably got enough answers to fill up that extra time, and I just hope y'all have enough questions too. I'll take the assumption that y'all, of course, are the same panel that we argued this before with, and you're familiar with the facts and the procedural history. The first and primary thing that I want to emphasize in this argument is that as long as there have been judicial courts in Texas, we've recognized that interpretation of Texas constitutional provisions must at least as a starting point look at the intent of the Texas framers, the delegates to the Texas constitutions, and the people that ratified provisions of our state constitution. I think probably in the course of this process, the arguments maybe of my opposing counsel as well as some of the decisions that have come out, both from the trial court forward, seem to have lost sight of that fact, where we get into a reliance upon federal circuit courts of appeals from thousands of miles away to tell us what the framers of the Texas constitutions understood and intended, and the people that ratified those provisions intended. From the get-go, even as far back as the trial court, I provided the trial court and every court since then with legal treaties that were contemporaneous with both the adoption but not ratification in 1836 of the Texas Due Course of Law provision. And I provided treaties that were before and at the time contemporaneous with the 1845 adoption, and in that case, actual ratification of the Texas Due Course of Law provision. All of those cases, all those treaties, and all the decisional law, even from other states and elsewhere, all make it real clear that mens rea was a fundamental principle. There has been or have been arguments made that there aren't any cases until the English decision in Regina versus Prince that ever directly addressed the question of whether mens rea as a fundamental requirement applied to statutory rape circumstances. You've heard this argument before, the fact of the matter is the legal age was 10 years old under the English common law as well as in the American common law until the very late parts of the 19th century. And so you didn't have any cases because a young lady that was 10 years old wouldn't often provide a circumstance where someone could make a plausible argument that they had reason not to know the age of the child. The first case we had in Texas was shortly after the statutory age in Texas had been raised, I believe, to 15 years. And it was within 2 years after that statutory change, I believe 1895, that we had the first case in Texas, the Edens decision. What I think is important about the Edens decision is that while the state may argue that there never had been a mens rea requirement at all with regard to statutory rape, the Edens court would not have gone out of its way to create an exception to deal with the mens rea requirement if the mens rea requirement wasn't applicable to statutory rape. The state, and of course by that I refer to this notion of transferred intent, is that as the court in Regina versus Prince, the English court had dealt with the issue for the first time under the English common law, they found that the principle of mens rea applied to statutory rape, but they came up with this theory that if what you were doing would be unlawful anyway, That is, by committing an adultery, having sex with someone other than your wife, or engaging in fornication, that is, having sex out of wedlock, that guilty knowledge could substitute for a lack of proof on the question of the age of the sex partner or the child. That is the exception that was applied in Edens in Texas, and I think that completely obliterates any argument the state has that mens rea never has and never should have applied to statutory rape, because they obviously dealt with it in Edens, and there had been no, if that was true, that there never was any mens rea requirement applicable to statutory rape, they wouldn't have needed to create that exception. Of course, as I explained in my brief, today the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that you have a liberty interest in having sexual relations outside of marriage, even if it's not recognized. Of course, we're not dealing with homosexuals in this case, but that's the Lawrence case I'm referring to, that they recognize that even if you're out of wedlock, it cannot be a criminal offense to have sexual relations with someone that's, of course, an adult. We're not claiming that my client has any constitutional right to have sex with minors. What we're claiming is that if he has a reasonable belief that he is having sex with an adult, and he's got proof, he should be allowed an affirmative defense, or the state even should be required to prove as an element that he either knew or should have known that the female or child was under the age of 17. That's what we're saying, and I don't think that it's that difficult. It doesn't create an undue burden on the state any more than the mens rea requirement imposes on the state in any and every other criminal offense it proves or is required to prove.
Why should it be different?
No, I'm saying it should be the same. I'm saying that there is no historical justification for treating statutory rape different than any other statute that requires mens rea. You've got offenses where, just about any offense. Of course, we have these statements in Ransom, which is one of the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals, saying that since ancient times, the offense of statutory rape has provided special protection. Well, that doesn't really say whether or not there was mens rea required from the very beginning either. You obviously had burglary and murder. They're also ancient offenses. And the fact that they are ancient in their vintage, historically, in no way provides an argument to say that mens rea doesn't apply to murder or burglary. And that's the problem I have with a lot of the reasoning that is derived from that Ransom decision, that says that just because an offense like statutory rape is ancient, then therefore there never was mens rea. Now, the state, of course, has, by using a delete button on its word processor, captured that quote from Edens and got rid of the part which would be unlawful in any event. And so they think that those words are so unimportant that we should just delete them out. And of course, it has a footnote saying, well, even if we left those in, it wouldn't change the nature of the ruling. Well, that is not legal reasoning. That's just someone fooling around with a word processor. And I'm sure the court will see through it that you can't take snippets out of rulings, say they don't mean anything, but if they do, they don't really mean anything. Some of the other arguments that have been made, although not necessarily before the court in this case, is something called the public welfare exception to the mens rea requirement. Many of the cases cited by the state deal with fact circumstances where actually there would be a public welfare exception established. We say that statutory rape by its nature is not a public welfare offense. It's not something where you're putting rotten eggs in the stream of commerce. It's not a highly regulated industry. There's several cases out there. I think the best one that I'd ask you to read is State versus Guest, which is the Alaska case that I do cite in my reply brief on remand, where they just flat out say that there's no basis to say that statutory rape is anywhere close to a public welfare because it's not an offense that threatens harm to the community at large. In a way, of course, it works as I say, all crimes, I guess, the state, the community at large has an interest in. But by saying that public welfare statutes place the entire community at risk, you're talking about things in the chain of commerce and those sorts of things. And that's just not the situation in a statutory rape case. The state notified me, although I was already aware of it, the Fourth Court of Appeals, in a case, Byrne, B-Y-R-N-E, came out, I believe, on November 16th of last month. And I tried to call the attorney for the appellant in that case to find out whether he had borrowed any of my briefs or not, and what his position was or what he knew about the reasoning, other, you know, behind the scenes reasoning or arguments that were made in his case, and I haven't heard back from him. I would urge you not to follow the reasoning in the Byrne case for several reasons. Number one, it's just kind of an error throughout the thing. First of all, as you may remember when we were here last, talking about whether Vasquez reached the constitutional question. And I provided a list of cases showing that it hadn't. The Court of Criminal Appeals in this case acknowledged that it had never decided the constitutional question. Yet, in the Byrne decision, they say that the Court of Criminal Appeals did reach the constitutional question in Vasquez. They make a number of other errors. And so I would urge you to not be influenced by the Byrne decision, because I think it's poorly reasoned, and I have to wonder even whether they obviously did not carefully read the authorities that they were relying on in that case. We think that the right not to be convicted of an offense of this degree, we're talking about felony offenses, we're talking about people having to register for the remainder of their lives as sexual predators, or being viewed by the community as sexual predators, places this type of offense in a category where there's even a greater liberty interest not to be convicted and have those lifetime consequences unless you can show some knowledgeable wrongdoing. This is not some kind of an offense where it's for example, a speeding ticket where nobody's really going to care whether you were convicted of speeding. It's a reportable sex offense, and people are naturally going to have my client labeled not just as someone who has sex with someone he thought was of legal age, but someone who was as some kind of a pervert or sexual predator. And I think the state should be, I think the mens rea requirement is there to guard against people from being criminalized when they've really done nothing wrong in their own mind. I have additional time. If the court doesn't have any questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Sure.
Could you just articulate or in capsule form whether your position is that the state due course of law provision provides greater protection than the federal due process provision?
Okay.
Or equal or less?
Well, of course, the only issue before the court is the state provision. I tend to think of it in terms of, and this is something that came up actually in the Court of Criminal Appeals, the reason for separately briefing a state constitutional provision and a federal provision is originally it was so that issues would not be presented together in a multifarious fashion. My brother, lawyer in Houston, I accuse of that all the time. He'll have one of these issues that cite statutory provisions and different constitutional provisions, and it's hard to deal with. The Court of Criminal Appeals in this case, and the reason for its remand was, is that so long as you're separately briefing them and relying on authorities that are more germane to, on the one hand, the state provision, and on the other hand, the federal provision, it doesn't really make any difference whether one is broader or not than the other, or you're going to end up requiring appellants to argue in the first half of the brief that the federal provision is more protective than the state, and then the second half of the brief argue conversely that the state's more protective than the federal. If sometimes you, I'm sure frequently, you are confronted with situations where someone claims a statutory violation, for example, in a motion to suppress, and a constitutional violation as a basis. You don't really have to show that the statute's broader than the Constitution or the Constitution's broader than the statute. You deal with them independently and just determine standing alone, freestandingly, which one or whether or not that provision has been violated. I know the concurring opinion in this case in the Court of Criminal Appeals, Judge Kiesler and I believe Judge Cochran, I'm not sure, indicated that they didn't see that that it would be unduly burdensome to treat the state provision differently than the federal constitution. And what I told them and what I'll tell you is that you're talking about two generations difference in the time period from 1791, when the federal constitution was ratified, and 1845, or if you want, 1836, when the state provision was ratified or adopted in Texas. You can't just imagine that nothing happened or everything froze. We do know there's a lot more publications, as these treaties that I cite demonstrate. The knowledge of the law was being more widely distributed after 1791 and before 1845. And every treatise that I've looked at, each one of them, that every time they've dealt with the mens rea, there is no exception at all. In this case, we can live with the idea that if you have knowledge that you're committing some other offense, you probably can be convicted without knowledge of age. But in this case, there is no culpable wrongdoing under any Texas statute that can substitute, like in years past would have been possible, for adultery or fornication. So to answer your question in short, I think both of them are violated by provisions such as this. When we were here and dealt with the federal issue before, I believe you still have that brief. The Supreme Court has never ruled one way or the other, but we do know in the video case that they implied a mens rea requirement to avoid grave constitutional concerns. And that grave constitutional concern indicates to me that they think mens rea applies to the knowledge of age requirement. And if it's going to apply, and whether you can be guilty of possessing child pornography, it seems to me that the same rationale would apply in a statutory rape context as well. But they have not reached that issue. I don't believe they've even had occasion to. And if there's no more questions, I'll reserve the balance.
Do you believe that or not that due process and due course are synonymous?
I don't think they're synonymous because both of them are derived from English common law and going back probably even to Roman civil law, quite frankly. The fact that they both have common lineage does not mean that there was no change in either understanding or beliefs between 1791 for the federal due process and 1845, what the framers, the delegates of the state constitution, and the people that ratified that constitution. You've got several generations difference in what people would understand the law was. And I don't really know that I can't tell you that there would be any demonstrable difference. What I'd say is I think more common people, understood mens rea in 1845 than they would have in 1791 after the American Revolution. Just because the difference in available sources of reading. Philadelphia, of course, is one of the most literate cities in revolutionary America. But I think probably there are even more people that had more literature available in 1845 of the legal variety, including the ones that I cite in the briefs.
Are you helping out here as a criminal specialist? There is the situation where clear and convincing evidence is required for the state to prove consent.
Under Texas.
In a different context.
Well, under the Texas Constitution, but not the federal. Right.
That's at least one example of where the Texas Constitution has been interpreted that way to provide greater protection. Can you tell us the reasons why the Court of Criminal Appeals did that and whether that kind of rationale would apply here as well.
Well, I think from the beginning of the development in modern times of there being an independent state interpretations, both in this state and other states, is it was motivated by a recognition that states have an independent duty to understand what the framers of their constitutions would have understood and what the people would have understood when they ratified their state constitutions. And that it's, you don't go by saying, well, since they something sent they put in their the state constitution something similar to what the framers of the federal constitution did in 1789 that was ratified in 1791. You don't just in lockstep assume that everybody's thinking the same thing, because you're talking about roughly 60 years difference, a couple of generations at least. You have different newspapers, articles, you have different events in history. And so you really don't just automatically assume if one, then the other. You look at what the state delegates and people of Texas in ratifying them would have understood and intended. And
one example of that, when you mention historical events, is would be, I think, Texas' special emphasis on the right to jury trial and the reason why it's emphasized because we were mistreated when we were part of Mexico.
That's right. And the bankruptcy law, or the homestead exemption in Texas historically is a lot more protected than any other state because of all these our deadbeat ancestors that came from Tennessee at the time that all the banks were foreclosing on everybody. So you really have to look at the constitutional provision in historical context at the time that it was adopted. Sometimes it'll be the same. There's really no reason to interpret them differently. Other times you might see a difference. And some of the documents that that I included, I think, in the initial brief, was talking about how Texans did not want vindictive justice. And they used those words, that they wanted their first penal code to be a reform of what had been pre-existing law to make sure there was not vindictive justice. And the fact that they would overtly and expressly say something like that indicates to me that it was not just kind of a platitude, that they really wanted, they were on a new frontier, they believed in individual liberties and the government staying out of their hair. At the same time, they certainly knew that there was a place for responsibility among their citizens. But if you think of the idea, and of course at that time, as I've said, the common law legal prohibited age was either 10 or 12 years old. I think the first Texas Penal Code actually made it 12. But in most states prior to that time, it was actually 10. And the notion that the Texans that formed our Constitution in 1845 would have this kind of draconian thing where if a girl is a day before 17, you get to register as a sexual predator for the rest of your life. But if she's a day older than that, or if it's after midnight and she's turned 17, you haven't committed any crime at all, seems to me totally absurd. I can't imagine anybody, even today, would think that that was fair. Judge Kiesler was concerned when we were in Austin about everybody just kind of putting up these phony defenses I didn't know. Well, if that's a problem, you're going to have jurors that are instructed on the law, and they can decide whether or not a person had a reasonable, objectively and subjectively, reasonable belief that a girl that he had sex with was 17 years of age or older. In this case, you've got the facts, and I don't think it's that unusual or uncommon, where you've got all these social media, you've got women that don't look under 17 like they may have in earlier ages, generations ago. They behave differently, they act differently, and I just think the framers of the Texas Constitution would have certainly understood the fundamental unfairness of having this offense so intrusively and permanently, and we're talking permanently, somebody having to register as a sexual predator when they have done nothing wrong in their own mind. And quite frankly, when we began the trial in this case, the DA and I both understood that that jury wasn't going to like it, that they were going to have to find my client guilty. Of course, we did work out a deal without the case going forward to the end of the trial. But I don't think jurors should be placed in that position. I don't think it was the ever intent of the framers of the Texas Constitution, and it just doesn't make sense, and it's unconstitutional under the due course of law provision.
Now I know you're about out of time, but I'd like to ask you to just about one aspect of the concurring opinion of the Constitution. That is this observation that the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals has not rendered an opinion on the scope of substantive rights protection supported by the due course of law provision, but has in several opinions found that in terms of procedural rights, the provision in the federal constitution and the Texas constitution should be treated as found provided the same privileges and protections.
Right.
And so how would you draw a difference in findings that there are from a procedural due process standpoint, the same protections in Texas as in the federal constitution? How would you distinguish that in substantive law as being different?
Okay. Well, first of all, although in a lot of published decisions, the difference or the distinctions between substantive due process and procedural due process are not always made as clear as they should be. Procedural due process, you're dealing with something I consider to be basically very simple, is notice and an opportunity to be heard. And the notion that depending on the liberty interest affected and the burdens that might be imposed on the government to have additional or different proceedings or procedures is factored into what is and is not constitutional as a matter of procedural due process. For that reason, I don't think that there would be any, in my mind, any real difference or need to recognize any difference between the federal and state provisions. Under the Texas due course of law provision, which does have a substantive component, there may very well be a need to have a different interpretation, because a one-size-fits-all approach that would be applied in a federal context, that is, you would assume that the people in California and Maine and Texas and Florida all would have one guidepost for what is and is not a violation of substantive due process. I don't think that was ever the intention of anyone, that Texas should have to interpret its state provision in lockstep with that one uniform standard that applies nationwide. I think the difference is, and I think I'm repeating myself, but for an interpretation of the state constitution, you really have to look at what was around, the legal treaties, the literature, the understanding of what the culture was like at the time that constitutional provision was ratified by the people. And I would be surprised if you would ever find that same, you might find similar. For example, you might have California, their constitution was roughly contemporaneous to our 1845. You might have some of the same cultural similarities, but other than that, there's no reason to think Texas provision was understood to mean the same thing by the same people in Maine.
So
or
you differentiate between procedural and substantive.
Yeah, yeah.
On the basis that
that's right.
Substantive provisions in the Texas due course of law are just simply different than the procedural interpretations that have been given on the basis that both provisions provide the same thing.
Well, I'm not sure I followed your question entirely, but if I do, what I'd say is the definition or the substance of due course of law in Texas has to be measured by, as all these cases I've cited said, by the understanding or intent of the framers and the people who ratified it. And that may or may not be the same as framers and ratifiers in other states at different times in history. I'd be surprised if they were. I think you should approach the Texas provision almost sui generis. Now, of course, it is going to be derived from similar principles going back to the common law of England. And like I say, the thing that I want to make clear is this idea that mens rea never applied to statutory rape is just incorrect, or they would not have needed that exception, both in the English case, Regina versus Prince, and in the Texas case, Edens. If it didn't apply, they didn't need to get into this transferred intent exception.
Thank you for your very helpful.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Blyden. Ms. Lott?
May it please court, counsel. One point I'd first like to make is appellant has raised an as-applied challenge, but we really haven't gotten into the facts. He refers to 17 or younger. Here he was prosecuted under the statute, which is 14 years or younger. The victim in this case was 13 years old, and he was 24. I'd just like to make a point of that. The Court of Criminal Appeals directive in this case was to determine whether the state provision offers more protection than its federal counterpart, based on appellant's arguments and authorities, and I think they show no such thing. I spent hours going through old tomes and trying to torture some argument out of those that really supports the position that the two are different, and there's nothing there. Appellant points to Regina v. State. That case dealt with three different sections. The primary one was taking the child from the father, and in that they did kind of discuss what appellant's going into here, but they all also discussed sections 50 and 51, and those were the carnal knowledge of a child under a certain age. And in that case, there's no transferred intent discussed. They said the act done with mens rea is unlawfully and carnally knowing the girl, and the man doing that act does it at the risk of the child being under the statutory age. And Edens v. State cites to Regina v. Prince, and I don't think that appellant says that I delete that one phrase, but I do think if you read the sentence with that phrase in there or without there, it still stands for the basic proposition that the mens rea is not necessary in that situation. I think essentially appellant's citations, he cites to English authors and lawyers from the North, but I don't see how that contributes to a discussion of whether the state provision offers more protection than the federal provision. The Court of Criminal Appeals opinion in Autran set out the factors to do in this kind of analysis, and I'll just rely on the discussions in my brief on those factors. And unless there are any questions, I'll close.
Another statute that does not require mens rea at the moment.
You know what? I think in a way the drunk driving, DWI.
I do.
Yes, sure.
Ms. Luff, there's a part of our earlier opinion that's not really addressed in the remand or the concurring opinion, and that is the aspect that when it comes to a social evaluation of the requirement of our lack of a mens rea requirement, statutory right, but that is particularly a matter for the legislature.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
And that's not mentioned in the opinion. That was the remanding opinion.
It was discussed at the Court of Criminal Appeals. I know they were considering it. I don't know why it wasn't mentioned in the opinion.
Well, if that
would you mind repeating that one more time, Your Honor?
Yes, I'm trying to ask you about your position for the state as to whether the legislative decision to be made about requiring mens rea or not requiring mens rea in a strict liability situation in a statutory way. Is that to be applied differently if you're talking about procedural due process as opposed to substantive? due process?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. I haven't really thought about that. If you'd like, I could research it and tender.
I'm not aware of any case that makes that distinction, but it appears that the task we have of, of responding to the directive of the Court of Criminal Appeals that we're not addressing that part of our thinking in terms of looking at the legislature to be the place where a public policy matter, that kind of question should be addressed as opposed to a court opinion.
Yes, Your Honor. I agree with your assertion. I think, too, I remember from looking at this on a national scale way back when, that there was maybe only one court-made rule. There might have been four at one point, but one at the time we argued this, that was made by the court instead of the legislature on the statutory rate. You're welcome.
Rebuttal?
Yes. I'm not sure how much time. I won't take too much. Justice Meyer, what you're just referring to brings to mind a statement in the Byrne decision from the Fourth Court of Appeals. What it rules is the legislature has discretion to, quote, define and punish any act as a crime. We still have a constitution. You guys still have jobs. If it was really true that the legislature could make anything a crime, no matter whether it had a mens rea requirement or not, regardless of whether someone got notice of something being illegal, there wouldn't be a judicial branch of government in this state. Understand?
I start with the proposition that I fully agree with you that
thank you.
The powers of the legislature are limited by the Constitution.
Thank you. And that was my concern. That was one of the problems I had with the Byrne decision, is that's the basis for the reasoning, is that the legislature has discretion to define and punish any act as a crime.
Well, I don't know. I have to look at the context of that statement.
I understand. I understand.
I know it would not be intending that to be perhaps as broad as maybe what you're
discussing. Well, right. And of course, I think I probably would agree with them that they do have discretion to enact whatever provisions they want to. You and I both, I think, are in agreement, and I think most people would be, that the Constitution does provide some limitations on what they can do and they can't do. Now,
Marbury versus Madison is still the law.
I haven't thought about that one a long time, but that is actually true, is that you as a judicial branch do declare what the law is. The state indicated that they still dispute the fact that both the Regina versus Prince, the English decision, as well as Edens versus State, actually did rest upon the transferred intent. On page 8, 6 of my reply brief on remand, I cite several scholars, Rollins M. Perkins in Criminal Law, 1957, Wayne Lefebvre and Austin W. Scott, that's a handbook on criminal law from 1972, the Model Penal Code commentaries, and other authorities that all recognize that that Regina versus Prince relied on this transferred intent exception to mens rea. They want to try to avoid that conclusion because obviously the fact that they had to create an exception to mens rea in Regina versus Prince and in Edens, the Texas decision, is conclusive proof that they knew mens rea applied. Then you get into the question of, since those offenses that at the time would have provided a intent that could be transferred because you knew you were engaging in fornication or adultery, because those offenses aren't around it, somebody's got to come up with an offense that the intent can be substituted or used to substitute for the lack of knowledge. As far as DWI goes, a person can't be convicted of DWI unless they had intent or a constructive notice of the effects of the intoxication. They obviously don't have to show someone intentionally drove, but they have to show they were not slipped a Mickey or had some kind of involuntary intoxication. You have to knowingly consume alcohol or a drug to be guilty of driving while intoxicated. So that's not exactly analogous to what you were referring to. We do know we have speeding tickets. Speeding does not have to require a knowledge of your speed. But the reason why that doesn't fit into the general mens rea requirement is because of the very low level of punishment, a fine-only offense. And, of course, it might also very well fall into a public welfare category where the public at large is endangered by someone that's speeding. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you both for your arguments. Very good. Very good briefs. Would it be helpful, I'll address this to both of you, would it be helpful to us to listen to the Court of Criminal Appeals' arguments? Are they available? And or the briefs that were filed?
I have no objection. I think that's, you can take judicial notice of that. One thing I forgot to mention is, as you probably have realized, I spent a lot of time working. And I'm concerned that the decision in the Fourth Court of Appeals is going to get up to the Court of Criminal Appeals before I can get there, at least to weigh in on it. I know y'all have a backlog of many, many cases, but if you could do whatever you could, however you do it, I would appreciate it if we could get this thing kind of accelerated to the extent it can be so that I'll have an opportunity, or the state will have an opportunity to weigh in on the ultimate resolution of this. And I think this case is the better vehicle for the Court of Criminal Appeals.
Do you know what the status is of the San Antonio case? It is it on rehearing?
It came out on November 16th. On the webpage, that it says it's being held, but I assume that that's only, there may be, it doesn't show a pending motion for a rehearing. It doesn't show the filing of the PDR. I would assume that they argued, since I can't help but think that the attorney for the appellant knew that this is an issue that's kind of bouncing around in the courts, and he will be filing a petition, but I don't know that for sure. He has to call him back. I'm not expecting they'll come out with a decision just immediately, obviously, but it would probably take them a few months to get around, obviously, to have a briefing and other things in that court. But I don't mean to brag, but I'm sure that I would have a lot of information that would help the court and the state. I think probably is more familiar with this than the district attorney's office in Bexar County as well. So just if you can, I know it's unusual, but if you can, try to deal with this as soon as possible. And as far as hearing it, the Court of Criminal Appeals argument, I have no problem. You can find it. I've actually got it posted. If you want, I can send you a clerk a link to it. I had somebody who knew how to post those things on the website or something. Because ordinarily they don't broadcast it.
I certainly have no objections to listening to it either. I just like to warn you, it seems to me, if I remember correctly, a lot of it was discussing whether or not to remand this back to the state to look at the state issues. I'm not sure a lot of it would be that helpful.
Well, no, actually, that came up at the very end.
Okay.
That came up. That was one. So, I thought we granted this and decided whether it should be remanded, and that was news to me because they did grant all the substantive issues, all four of them, and there never was really a question that I was prepared to start discussing about whether it should be remanded. It was kind of out of the blue. But if you like, I can send the link to someone so y'all don't have to.
Okay, that would be helpful.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both. Your case is submitted. And we will stand adjourned for the day.